All right. It is so good to be here. This is my 44th state to speak in the United States of America. And all the last ones I'm getting to are out here in the West, and it's pretty awesome. I wish I could stay a couple days longer and kill something like a big moose or something like that, because I'm not your ordinary college professor. I'm a member of the National Rifle Association, and I write all my books and columns sitting in my office surrounded by two gun safes and more guns than I'm going to admit, because I think the government might be listening to this speech, and dead stuff all around me and all of that. But I wasn't always that way. I was in 1993, all kidding aside, I was hired as a college professor by the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. And I was hired as a liberal and an atheist back then. And I took the job. And then later on, I converted. And it's funny, I did not join the Republican Party or the NRA until after I had tenure. And now they're stuck with me. And it has been just an unbelievable bunch of fun. I like to call myself a community disorganizer. Do with that what you may, ladies and gentlemen. But I am here to talk to you about some things that I think actually are very, very serious. There'll be a lot of humor in this, but I'm going to be talking about some serious things because I think that what is happening on our college campuses these days are things that you need to pay attention to, because what happens on the campus today is what is going to happen in the culture tomorrow. The crazy things that you see on the college campus today are going to be normal within 20 years in the larger society. And so we have to be paying very careful attention. So what I'm going to do this evening and in the morning, I'll spend about an hour talking about the issue of free speech on campuses. I'll spend about an hour talking about the issue of freedom of association on campuses. Towards the end of talking about how we can fight back to get our voices heard on college campuses and preserve our liberties, including our religious liberties in the larger society. And then tomorrow I'll shift a little bit and say, okay, well, once we've won our liberties and the right to speech, how do we have conversations with people? Because it's one thing to have a right to speak and another thing to know what to say once you've got it. And so in the morning, I'll spend about an hour talking about how we navigate the conversation surrounding abortion. And then I'll spend about an hour talking about how you have a conversation with a kid who you loved, and then they went off and took a sociology course at a public university, and their worldview just got turned on its head. How do you have a conversation with that person and reel them back in? So that's what we'll be talking about. But, you know, of all the different things that I do, I've traveled across the country and I've given speeches on, I think, 77 different campuses across America. And I do speak on a variety of issues. Sometimes I'll just go and give pro-life apologetics, for example, just teaching young people how to argue the abortion issue. But if there's one issue that I've talked about the most on the campuses, it's been the issue of what I call basically a constitutional crisis in higher education, which is just the all-out assault on freedom of expression and speech on our college campuses. And what's interesting is that I actually got interested in this topic back in 1992 when I was a graduate student at Mississippi State University. I was getting my PhD in criminology, which is embedded within a sociology department, and I was finishing up on my dissertation, and I was working. I was playing in a band back then. I was a leftist. I had hair down to here. I won't show you pictures. I've destroyed all of them. But at any rate, I was reading a little bit on the side, and I was not really a leftist back then. I was a liberal in the sense that I still had some idea about tolerance and respect for free expression of ideas. And I'd read Rush Limbaugh's books, and I've got an old book of Rush Limbaugh, and back then I was lost and everything. And boy, are there some profane words written on just about every single page of that book back when I was very hostile towards conservatism. But at least I was reading the other side at that time. And not enough people do that in our society these days. They just go pick the people they agree with and read them. And we've got all these different segments of society that are really ideological echo chambers, where no one grows and where no one ever learns. And there's nothing worse than the public university these days. They are absolutely the worst. And I knew something was a little bit wrong back in 1992 when I read this book by a guy by the name of Dinesh D'Souza. And the book is called Illiberal Education. And I read this thing, and I was supposed to hate conservatives back then, but I read the book and I just found myself agreeing with so much that he had to say. And he wrote this unbelievable chapter in the book, And it was the very first exposure. It was about campus political correctness. And it was the very first exposure that I ever had to the idea of the campus speech code. And it was this case that had just taken place at the University of Pennsylvania, and it's known as the infamous Water Buffalo episode. Now, raise your hands out there if you have ever heard of this infamous case, because this is the one that really grabbed my attention. I wouldn't be standing here today speaking to you if this case didn't grab me, if I didn't just kind of get sucked into the campus free speech movement. But it's one that really grabbed a hold of me because it involved this kid at an Ivy League school, the University of Pennsylvania. This Jewish kid was a very, very serious student, and he had gone to his dormitory one night, and he was studying really hard, and it was a cool night, and so he'd opened up the windows to his dorm, and his dorm overlooked the quad at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was trying to study when all of a sudden he heard this sorority out there in the middle of the quad just making all kinds of noise. And if you went to a school that had a strong Greek system, you know there is only one way to describe sororities: loud. When they get together, there's a lot of giggling and a lot of laughing. And I don't mean to stereotype, but some stereotypes are true, ladies and gentlemen. And he sat there and he was just so annoyed that he got up and he walked over to the windows and he shut them. But as he was shutting them, he goes, "Why don't you shut up, you bunch of water buffaloes?" And he just shut the door, shut the window, and he didn't really think about it. Now, I don't know about you, but when someone's loud and they get on my nerves, I always shout, "Hey, shut up, you bunch of water buffaloes," right? Of course not. I have no idea what that means. But all of a sudden, he gets a knock on the door. Not all of a sudden, I think it was the next day. And it was someone from the Dean of Students' office. And they knock on the door and they notify him that he's being charged with racial harassment. He had no idea that it was a black sorority. And so at this point, he's informed that he's getting charged with racial harassment, but he can't figure out what the water buffalo thing had to do with race. Because he's Jewish, and the word bohema, it just means loud person. And it translates into English as water buffalo. And he tries to explain that it's a completely racially neutral concept. They don't care. So they bring him up on these charges. They actually have this little trial where they're considering whether they're going to expel him. And in the midst of all this, the campus newspaper picks it up and they write about it saying, what does this have to do with race? A local newspaper picks it up, and thank goodness, there was a Jewish professor at the school by the name of Alan Charles Kors, who is a very distinguished professor of history. And he hears about the case and he says, "Wait a second, I'm Jewish too." And we used that term when I was growing up, and it's absolutely racially neutral. So it's like you're persecuting him. You're being ethnically insensitive by forcing your meaning of the word upon his culture. This is nonsense. And so he just, because he has tenure, he keeps writing about it, he keeps talking about it, it becomes a national news story. And at some point, the University of Pennsylvania realizes it's not worth pursuing the charges against these kids, against this kid, because this is hurting them badly in the court of public opinion, because they can't even explain the racial connotation. And so it was very interesting because Alan Charles Kors saw this, and he was so appalled by the due process violations, the way they handled him, and they bring him in and they threaten him with expulsion. They won't give him an attorney. And he decides that he's going to write a book, and the book is called Shadow University, talking about how college students are treated and how we treat them like it's like the old English Star Chambers or something. And he writes this book, and eventually he will found an organization which is known as the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or the FIRE. And I want to very, very strongly encourage all of you guys to make a note of their website. It's www.thefire.org. It's real simple, thefire.org. And the reason why I direct you towards them is that they do a massive investigation of colleges across the country, public universities and private universities, and they rate them for how ridiculous they are on the issue of free speech. They give you a green light or a yellow light or a red light. So if you guys are trying to figure out where are you going to send your kid off to college and you have to make a serious decision and you're stuck between two colleges, if you know that one college, like the University of Virginia, has got a green light and another one you're considering, like Bucknell, has a red light every single year, well, guess what? That's a tiebreaker for you. You can use that, and that will be a gauge as to how your young person, your loved one, how they will experience college. Will they really experience a university environment that really is the quintessential marketplace of ideas? So I read this book by D'Souza in 1992. I took a job as a liberal atheist in 1993 at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. And as soon as I got there, the very first semester, having heard something about the campus speech codes, I decided that I would look at the faculty handbook and see what our speech code said. And we had a campus speech code that said that people had a right to be free from speech that made them feel uncomfortable. Well, I read this speech code and I was just utterly appalled because it is my belief that the Constitution gives us a right to be offended and to be offended with regularity. You see, there's this exchange that goes on. If you want to be free to speak your mind, that means there's a good chance that you're going to offend someone and they can't say that they are offended and negate your free speech. That's known in First Amendment law as a heckler's veto. They can't throw a hissy fit and say, shut up, and the government can't come along and take their side. But there's an exchange that goes on, isn't there? If you exercise your right to free speech and potentially offend someone else, they get to speak their mind as well, and you might be offended. And so I believe that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution gives us a right to feel very uncomfortable and to feel uncomfortable with regularity because it beats the heck out of living in comfort in a place like Cuba where you don't have a free and open marketplace of ideas, ladies and gentlemen. So I read this in the office my very first semester, and my chair, department chairperson, Stephen McNamee at the time, was in the office. And I remember reading it aloud to him. And I said, this is ridiculous. This wouldn't pass constitutional muster if someone were someday to file a lawsuit. This violates the First Amendment. You can't ban all speech that makes someone uncomfortable because, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, every idea is an incitement. And he said, well, you know, they're only talking about certain types of speech. And that's when I knew that we're in very serious trouble in higher education. When you actually hear an administrator openly admit, well, we can't go out there and ban all offensive speech. We just have to pick winners and losers in the marketplace of ideas. And as I read that speech code, I knew that it was going to be trouble. But I had no idea that later on the university would come after me with one of those speech codes and it would change the course of my life forever. It happened the week of 9/11, and I'm sure most of us in this room remember 9/11 and where we were and what we were doing. And I think it affected all of us. It affected our view of the world. It affected probably our cynicism, our innocence, in a sense. It affected so many things. It made us probably think about Islam for the first time, and what do these folks believe in, and what are the differences between us and them. But for me, it had an even greater impact, because 4 days after the attacks of 9/11, a former student of mine by the name of Rosa Fuller, who was a communist, she was just openly, I don't say that to be derisive, she embraces the terminology. She came to my class every day wearing a beret and combat boots. She was wanting to start her little revolution, but she was against guns, and I was always like, how are you going to start the revolution? I'm in the NRA, and we're not exactly shaking in our boots because you're unarmed, okay? But at any rate, she sent out this email that basically said, and I'll paraphrase it just a little bit, but she said basically that the attacks of 9/11 were the fault of the United States of America because we had done certain things in the realm of foreign policy that had caused people to hate us. And, what did we expect, basically? That was a big mistake because I had friends that lived in New York City, and we didn't know for 6 weeks afterwards, you know, where they were. You couldn't make a phone call into New York City for 6 weeks after 911. Not only that, but right around that weekend, Rudy Giuliani had issued an order to the federal government, Red Cross and the federal government. He was asking various sources. He said he needed 30,000 body bags. Well, everyone thought that meant that 30,000 people had died, and he knew it, and we weren't let on yet. He actually meant that a lot of bodies had been blown into various parts, and they'd have to have separate body bags. We just didn't know. So everyone is just really angry and distraught and upset 4 days after 911. And she sends this thing to me, and the reply that I wrote to her was absolutely unprintable. So I did the right thing. I hit the delete button. Don't ever hit the send button when I'm done. I mean, that piece of advice right there is all you need from the talk. Don't ever hit the send button when you're angry. But that is an important lesson. So I rewrote my response to her, and I said, you know, the Constitution protects your speech just as it has protected bigoted, unintelligent, and immature speech for many years. I basically said that was a dumb thing to say. It was a childish thing to say, and it wasn't very bright. But then I said, but you know what? The Constitution protects your speech. But you got to understand, you know, you asked me. She sent it to me and asked me to circulate it to people who might want to see it. I sent it to my friends in the military, basically. I sent it to Camp Lejeune. Oh, you asked me to. And I sent it to my friends, and a lot of them just responded with Semper Fi, basically. But, you know, I said, you've got to understand that you open yourself up for criticism when you write things like this. And it was a very tame response. And I thought that that was the end of the matter. Of course it wasn't the end of the matter, because if that was the end of the story, I am the worst speaker on the planet, because that just wasn't very exciting. What happens afterwards was that the provost for the university contacted me and said, Mike, we've got a little bit of a problem. He said, you know, the mother of the student is a college administrator, and her mother was working in the administration, and she has made a request. They're trying to charge you with libel, and they're trying to say that you violated the email use policy. There was a speech code that was attached to the email at the university, and he said, they are requesting to read all of your emails that you sent for an entire 1 week period, including private addresses that I'd written off campus. They wanted to go in and read them, and they also wanted a log of all of the private email addresses of all of my friends that I talked to that week. And so the provost sat there, and he said, you know, we're going to have to do this. And I said, no, you're not. He said, well, it's in the policy. And I said, well, no. I said, John, I was talking to my boss at this point, but I was, as Doc Noble would say, I was tickied off at this point. And I said, you know, I've got to explain something to you. The First Amendment to the United States Constitution protects my speech. But you're saying that the email policy at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington says that you can punish me for my speech. I said, John, what we have here is a conflict of laws. And we have to decide which law reigns supreme. Is it the Constitution of the United States of America, or the email use policy of the University of North Carolina at Wilmington? I said, do you understand today's civics lesson? And he's like, oh my goodness, I don't like the way this guy is talking to me, but he's right. And he said, okay, basically, I understand. And I said, this will go away. It didn't go away. About a week later, the university attorney calls me and says, well, you know what? We're going to have to go in and read your messages and determine whether they're public records, and maybe turn over some of this information to the other side. And something about it legally didn't ring true. And I sat there, and there was this moment where I actually thought about getting on the phone and apologizing to this administrator, because the thing had kind of leaked out in the local press. And I actually almost picked up the phone one day and made an apology. But I'll tell you something, I really started to think about my seventh grade grandfather who fought in the American Revolution. He fought in the American Revolution at the age of 13. He was shot and barely survived at the age of 15. He was one of George Washington's troops. I had one grandfather in World War I, one grandfather in World War II, And I just decided I'm not apologizing to anyone for exercising the rights that those men fought for. So I made another phone call. I called 215-717-3473. That is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And I called and I said, I don't think they can do that. And they said, oh, you're absolutely right. This is a good one. And they got on the phone. They got on the phone and they called John Leo of U.S. News and World Report. And basically, they just wanted to know if the university was going to go through it. They called me into this dark room. And I actually went in there and watched them read personal email addresses. And some of them, email messages, some of them were kind of funny. I was writing about the situation and I said, yeah, she's a commie and her mommy is a commie. And then, you know, some of them were actually, there's funny rhymes in there and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, they went through and they couldn't find anything in there that actually was a public record that they had access to. So the university then prints off a log of the private email addresses of everyone that I contacted that week. It just gave it to these people. And so I called the fire again, and John Leo of U.S. News and World Report, he actually called the university and he said, why did you read those guys, that guy's private emails? And the university responded by saying, we didn't. John Leo called me at home and he said, someone is lying to me. It's either you or the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. I said, I'll take a polygraph. He said, you're not lying. And I'm going to print this in U.S. News and World Report on Monday. And I said, oh, giddy up. This is getting interesting. So I walk into Barnes & Noble, and there's this write-up, and all of a sudden my university is in the national news. And it's pretty cool, but things got a little bit cooler the next day when I get a phone call at the office. It's Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity read it, and he says, well, why don't you come on Hannity and Combs? And I'm like, oh, that okay, I'll do that. And I show up in this Fox News studio to talk about the whole issue, and I'm there, and I'm they're not in person, but I'm hearing it, you know, and I'm sitting there looking into a camera, and I can't see him. And all of a sudden, the whiny voice of Alan Combs comes on. And I thought it was like some liberal conspiracy when all of a sudden Combs jumps in and says, I don't agree with any of your politics, Mike Adams, but that's just ridiculous. You can't do that. That's a serious invasion of privacy. And he says, I can get some attorneys from the ACLU to represent you. And I said, no, thanks. I said, I've got better attorneys than that. We went back and forth, and it was kind of funny. But then the thing goes viral, and what was amazing was Rush Limbaugh picked it up, and everyone on the right agrees with me. But you know what was fascinating about it was that NPR and the Boston Globe and other sources, the Chronicle of Higher Education on the left, actually jump in on my side. And the entire thing completely blows up, and it makes national news. And all of a sudden, the university is getting bombarded with thousands upon thousands upon thousands of emails. Why did you read the messages, and why did you lie? And they came up with a form response. And the form response says, we support Mike Adams' right to speak out on any issue whatsoever. I framed that response and put it on the wall of my office. And at the end of a very crazy semester, I sat down and I said, you know, I've seen some crazy things going on this campus. I think I'm going to actually sit down and write an expose of campus life. I did that over the next 6 months. I wasn't real satisfied with it. So I turned and I went and I got a column writing for the American Family Association's Agape Press. And I start writing a monthly column about how there is all this hypocrisy when it comes to free speech and tolerance being a one-way street on our campuses. My first column was called The Campus Crusade Against Christ. And I wrote 10 of them over a 10-month period. And then all of a sudden, hit the jackpot. Rush Limbaugh reads one on the air, and Bill O'Reilly is driving to work, and he hears it. Bill O'Reilly calls the office and says, would you like to come on the O'Reilly Factor? I'm from Texas, two-word response, giddy up, basically. I go on national television, and there's a guy by the name of Jonathan Garthwaite who's watching, and he happens to be the editor of townhall.com. And he says, basically, we'd like you to write every week. And I said, I don't think I can do this every week. But you know, as soon as I started writing a column in a broad forum, everyone started coming to me. I'd write about an issue, and all these students start to write, and faculty members and staff members saying, something exactly like that happened to me. And then all of a sudden, my once-a-week column became twice a week. Over the course of the next 10 years or so, I would write, you know, I've written 900 columns since then. The whole thing has exploded. 4 columns into this, I get a book contract, I rewrite the expose and publish it, and then I get invited to CPAC. Young America's Foundation invites me to join their speaking team, and then I move from there to speaking on 77 campuses all across America. On one of those campuses, Frank Turek heard me, I got invited to Summit, and that's how I got to be here. Everything exploded because there was a decision point in my life where I had to decide, am I going to sit there and remain quiet and apologize for exercising my rights, or am I actually going to stand up and do something about it? And it completely affected the course of my life. And I tell that story so that everyone will be encouraged, because I believe that each and every single one of us is going to reach a point in our life where we have to make a decision. Am I going to sit down and shut up, or am I going to stand up and fight? But I share the email story for a different... It's not just a rah-rah motivational speech. I share the story of what happened to me for a different reason. When I first started getting into this, I honestly believed that the problem on our college campuses was that we had administrators who were ignorant of the First Amendment. You remember the conversation I was having with John Kavanaugh where I'm giving him a civics lesson. I learned very quickly that they are not ignorant of the First Amendment, that they are hostile towards the First Amendment. And they are trying to write a series of policies and procedures that will paper over our constitutional rights. And we have got to fight back against the tide. That's what it taught me. And it also taught me that when they're caught, they will lie. The college administrator's argument is always 5 words. Liar, liar, pants on fire. And that's what they said to me. That guy's lying. We didn't read his email. And at that point, when they begin to sling the mud and to defame you, that is the point where you need to stand up and be strong and fight back and understand that you've got friends out there. If you're a college freshman and something's going on and it's not right and you think someone's violating your rights, guess what? The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education has conservatives, liberals, libertarians, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Democrats, Republicans, pro-lifers, pro-choicers. They will represent anyone because they stand on the side of principle. And you need to understand that you're not alone. That was the first great organization to arise in this country to defend freedom of expression. But you know, something else came out of it. There was a guy who I respect tremendously by the name of David French. He is my attorney. And we just won a huge case in federal court last week. I want to talk about that, but I'm saving that one till tomorrow night. The fact of the matter is that he was once the president for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. In January of 2006, I got a phone call from him that would definitely change the course of my work that was very important. He'd been working for the FIRE for just about 18 months as their president. Now, you got to understand something about the FIRE. The FIRE fights in the court of public opinion. They believe, as Justice Brandeis once said, that sunlight is the most powerful of disinfectants. But they actually don't get out there and litigate. And David French called me in January of 06, and he says, I'm ready to get back in the courtroom. And he said, I've also decided to join the Army and go to Iraq and be a JAG lawyer and also oversee interrogations of Al-Qaeda operatives. And he said, FIRE won't let me do that, so I'm leaving the FIRE and I'm joining this group called the ADF, previously known as the Alliance Defense Fund, now known as the Alliance Defending Freedom. So he calls me on the phone in 2006, and he says, we're starting this new wing of ADF, and it's going to be called CAF, the Center for Academic Freedom. And he says, I just got off the phone with David Horowitz, and I'm calling you, and I'm asking for favors. And I said, well, what do you want from me? He said, well, what I want you to do, since you've started speaking on all these college campuses across America, he said, what I would like for you to do is to go and recruit plaintiffs. And what I want you to do is go to the campuses that have the absolutely most insane policies and find people who have actually been a victim of these policies and bring them to me. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, he wants me to be a community disorganizer. I kind of like that. It's like I just bring the bad university code together with the good plaintiff and the good attorney, and then I just ride off in the sunset, basically, and let the lawyers do all the difficult stuff. Well, when he called me, I said, you know, it's interesting, David. I said, I immediately am already thinking of a university. It's actually not a university. It's an institute. Georgia Institute of Technology. And that's kind of weird for most of you. You know, you think about the problem of political correctness or rampant leftism on college campuses. What do you think about? Maybe a secular public university or maybe a crazy Ivy League school. You don't think about Georgia Institute of Technology. You think about a bunch of guys walking around with pocket protectors and slide rules and actually being involved in, you know, it ain't rocket science. Well, actually, it is rocket science here at Georgia Tech. You don't think of the problem of political correctness. But I'd once given a speech there, and at the speech, they had decided to move us from this big room that had 225 seats to a smaller one that had 40 seats at the very last. The problem was we had a couple hundred people come to that speech. And they said, we need the room for coming out counseling. It was coming out week at Georgia Tech. And so they moved us, and we went and put up a sign on the door. We went in there. There was one homosexual and one counselor in there, and like 223 open seats. They'd moved us, and we put up a sign, and they took it down. And they said, all the sign was my name and the cover of my first book. And they said, we're sorry, but his name and his book cover might be offensive to some of our students who are coming in for coming out counseling. And so what they had done is to actually take that down under the campus speech code. So I knew that we actually had a university that had a crazy speech code and they were exercising it very broadly. Well, what I didn't know was that on February 15th, about a month after that conversation with David French, I would get an extremely interesting phone call from a young woman who's an American hero by the name of Ruth Malhotra. She calls me on the phone, and she is very upset. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, we've gotten into trouble at Georgia Tech. And, you know, she's upset, but inside I'm going, yes, I think I know what this is all about. And she explained to me that the night before, she had gone to a play, and I will say the name of this play one time and one time only. It's The Vagina Monologues, and it ain't pretty, ladies and gentlemen. They had heard that this feminist play that's put on college campuses on Valentine's Day across the country was just extremely obscene. If you know anything about the play, one of the skits that they have, the feminist will actually get up and put on this play, and they will repeat the most offensive words that are used to describe women, the B word, the C word, just awful words. And they will say them over and over because they think if they repeat the word over and over, it will lose its capacity to control women. So if you say dirty words about female genitalia, then somehow it will be empowering. I don't know. I think the more often that you repeat obscenity in public, the stupider you look. I don't think that it makes you empowered. I mean, my goodness, when you're in third grade and you hear a dirty word for the first time, you repeat it over and over and over again. You either grow out of that or you become a campus feminist, to be honest with you. And so they put on this play. And what happened was that they decided, it was her and an Orthodox Jewish student by the name of Arit Sklar, they decided it wasn't proper for them to complain about the play unless they'd actually seen the play. And so they went and they sat through it. And the next day, they were so appalled by the language that they set up a booth and a table. It's like this table at the Georgia Institute of Technology. If you've ever been there, they have a gorgeous student union, and right out in front of it, they've got this place called the Runway. And it is the most traversed area of the campus. And what they did was to set up this table, and they put a huge poster board, and it said, "We are not," and it had the C word in huge letters. It was spelled out. And they were protesting. They were like, "We don't think that word is dignified at all." What do you think happened when they set this thing up in the middle of the campus? You get all these engineer types walking by with their pocket protectors and their slide rules and tripping and falling over themselves when they see the word. And they stop and they ask, what kind of a person uses that kind of language in public? And they said, we'll tell you what kind of a person does. It's the feminist in the women's center. They think it's cute. They think it's empowering. We think it's profane. And they said, well, that's just stupid. Well, why don't you go in the women's center? It's right. And so why don't you tell them what you think? Why don't you exercise your free speech rights? Well, all of a sudden, all these students at Georgia Tech take them up on the offer. And they go walking in the women's center. And the feminist didn't think it was funny at all. Shocker. And they come walking out armed, not with a gun, of course. They don't have guns, but they do have magic markers. And they actually came walking out and they looked at the sign and they took magic markers and they started to mark over the sign and cover it with permanent ink. And so Ruth and Reed are standing there going, what do you think you're doing? And the feminist said, you can't use that word. And they said, we just went to the V monologues last night. We heard you use that word over and over and over again. And the feminist administrator responded by saying, oh, but yes, when we used it as a term of endearment. When you use it, you're using it as a term of derision. And that violates the Georgia Tech campus speech code. Ladies and gentlemen, 1984 is here. It got there 22 years late in 2006. But is it amazing? You hear of the concept of the thought police. But this was a literal attempt to make an argument at a publicly supported university that the constitutionality of a word turns upon the thought you're having at the time you express it. If you're thinking angry thoughts, unconstitutional. If you're thinking of frozen lilacs in a spring field or having happy thoughts, well then, it's constitutionally protected. That is insane. And they called and they said, what do we do? I said, what do you do? It rhymes with do. You sue, of course. It's a slam dunk. But they didn't want to sue their university. Understandably so, they love Georgia Tech. They just started to see things going downhill a little bit in recent years. And that's when I called David French on the phone. And I said, you know, we've got the perfect plaintiffs, but they don't want to do it. You know what he did? He got in his car in Nashville, Tennessee, and he drove all the way down to Atlanta, Georgia. And he sat down face to face with Ruth Malhotra and Arit Sklar. And he said, it has come to my attention that you guys don't want to follow this suit. I don't have much time because I'm about to go to Iraq in a few months. And when I go to Iraq, I'm going to be overseeing interrogations of Al-Qaeda operatives. And people are going to be shooting at me while I defend constitutional principles in a very unpleasant environment. But I understand that you guys aren't willing to defend our freedoms here in the United States of America while no one is, in fact, shooting at you. That's what Mike Adams tells me. Is that correct? And essentially, they say, give us the form. And they signed up for the suit. And I wish I could tell you that the thing was just, you know, it saw the light of day and it went away immediately, but it didn't. The litigation went on for 2.5 years. And I will never forget the conversation that I had with Ruth Malhotra in February of 2008 while that litigation was still going on. I was giving a speech at CPAC. And she said, will you come down to the hotel lobby so I can talk to you later on tonight? I need to talk to you. And she sat there and she said, you know, this lawsuit has destroyed my life. She had gotten death threats. On the one-year anniversary of the V monologues, someone had actually put a note on her car that said, on this Valentine's Day, you will be raped. She got a rape threat. She got a death threat. And all of a sudden, these people start to show up in her dormitory. It was a gay rights group called the GSA, the Great Gay Straight Alliance. And they started to protest, and they had signs that said, Ruth Malhotra is a Twinkie, B-I-T-C-H. they're upset because she's trying to get rid of the campus speech code. They're in favor of the speech code, but they're calling her the B word. And they're handing out Twinkies, and she didn't understand what the Twinkies meant until someone explained it to her. She's half Filipino, half Asian Indian. And they were passing them out to people and saying, "This is Ruth Malhotra. She may be yellow on the outside, but she's white on the inside." What they were saying is that the campus speech code is just for the dominant white male class. It is ugly, ugly class and race warfare on our college campuses, isn't it? They found a copy of a picture on the internet of Orit Sklar, descendant of Holocaust survivors, and they superimposed a swastika on her body and circulated across the internet. Unbelievable. A Nazi because she supports free speech. And Ruth is sharing all of this with me, and I don't know what to say to her. "You're doing the right thing. Hang in there, kid." The words just totally escape me. But I thank God Almighty that 7 months after that conversation, no, 6 months after that conversation, Judge Owen Forrester issued a ruling in that case in which he not only struck down the campus speech code at Georgia Institute of Technology, he told the Institute that they were not allowed to write any more speech or conduct policies at Georgia Institute of Technology for a period of 5 years without the express permission of the federal court. They not only lost the lawsuit, they got sent to their room and grounded for 5 years. It was unbelievable. And after they won the case, they have a hearing and they award attorney's fees to my good friend David French. They give him $202,000 so he can turn around and take that money and use it in litigation against the next rogue university. The story couldn't possibly get better now, could it? Yes, it could. Because in February of 2009, I'm at home. I didn't get invited to CPAC that year. I may or may not have said something offensive on national television that I'm not ready to talk about emotionally yet. Might have involved Ann Coulter and a little spat that we had, but that's for another day. The fact of the matter is I get this phone call, and it's Ruth, and she says, "You know, why aren't you here?" And I said, "Long story, but how is CPAC going?" And she says, "Well, we're just here after the Reagan dinner." By the way, the Reagan dinner is the most awesome part of CPAC because it's on the last full night, and they have this thing known as the Reagan dinner, and they give this award called the Reagan Award for the most outstanding up-and-coming conservative activist in the United States of America. And she calls me, and I said, "Well, how was the Reagan dinner?" And she said, it was fantastic. I said, "Well, who won the Reagan Award this year?" And she said, "You know, it's a funny thing, but one person didn't win the Reagan Award this year. Two people won it." And I said, "Ruth, I understand that you're from the South, but go ahead and finish the story. Just tell me who won the dadgum award." And there's this pause on the other line, and she said, "It was me and Orit." And my heart just sunk. They were on national television on C-SPAN getting the highest honor in the conservative movement. And I realized after that both of them, their careers were set. And now Ruth Malhotra is working for Ravi Zacharias Ministries there in Atlanta. She's got a dream job. I talk to her all the time, and she's the happiest young woman I know. Orit has been tremendously successful, but why? Because they responded to the call, and they realized we've got other allies as well. You see, in the previous story, I told you that we have got a group out there called the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. And they're an awesome group. They're wonderful because they recognize that sometimes you can win cases in the court of public opinion without filing a suit. But sometimes the Pharaoh's heart is hard, and we have to turn to a court of law. And that's why I shared that story with you. I want you guys to understand that there's a great group out there called the Alliance Defending Freedom. And they won that lawsuit. And when that lawsuit started, I had no idea that I would be one of their plaintiffs in 2007. And we just won a fantastic verdict in federal court last year. My goodness, I want to talk about it. The first case in American history where a college professor prevailed against a university for political retaliation in a jury trial. My case, represented by David A. French. They stood behind me and we succeeded because we not only have great attorneys, we've got awesome prayer warriors just like you. Thank you so much, all of you who prayed during that experience. But young people, you need to understand, you don't know how easy the case is going to be, how hard the case is going to be, how long the road is in front of you. You just know deep in your heart that you must do the right thing and defend freedoms in this country. And you must know that you have people standing behind you. But you guys also need to know something else. This whole campus speech code thing, it began with racial politics in the first wave, the Water Buffalo episode, and then it turned into feminist politics, cases like Sklar versus Clough, that was the official name of that lawsuit that I just told you about. But in recent years, it's taken an ugly turn into the area of sexual politics. And that's where our religious freedoms are implicated. You see, the very first case that I brought to the Alliance Defending Freedom was that conversation that I had on the 15th of February in 2006. I landed their second plaintiff on the 16th of February in 2006. I just happened to be flying out to Pennsylvania State University the next day. And I had no idea how corrupt they are. All of us now know how corrupt they were in that time period. And I don't have to talk about the Sandusky incident. But I went there and I gave a speech on campus speech codes. And as I was giving that speech, I met a young man by the name of A.J. Fleur. And A.J. Fleur was an impressive 19-year-old student in Penn State. And after the speech that I gave, we had a reception in the dormitory. And it was really nice. And he came walking up to me. And he was carrying this little brochure. And this brochure had the title Problem Child on the outside. And I said, "What is this?" He says, "This is a publication that's published with our student activities fees. But it's actually published by the Department of English. And it's where English students can write essays, they can write poetry, and they can write prose, and the university will publish it." And I said, "Well, why are you showing this to me?" And he said, "Turn to whatever page." And he's a Catholic, a devout Catholic student. And he shows me this poem. It's called Mother Teresa's, and it's one of those foul names that they use in that phase. It's to refer to her private parts. It's a very nasty thing. And I saw the title of it. And I looked at AJ and I said, "I don't want to read this." He goes, "No, you need to read this." And I could see a sense of urgency that he was getting at something. So I read the essay. It was the worst essay I have ever read in my entire life. I don't know if it was poetry or prose or what it was attempting to be, but it was about a young kid who says that he left the Catholic faith because he was having sexual fantasies about Mother Teresa. And he went in to confess to a Catholic priest. And while he was in there, the Catholic priest reached across and grabbed him and started fondling him. This was around the time of all the pedophile scandals that were going on in the Catholic Church at that time. Very, very tough period in the church. And so he's writing about this. And then at the very end of this poem or prose or whatever it was, he says, "I sure hated being one of those Catholics, but at least I'm not a Jew." And it was just the weirdest thing I'd ever read. I mean, it was obviously very anti-Catholic, right? It was obviously very anti-Semitic. It was also very profane. So I finished reading it, and I said, "You better have a very good reason for making me read that, because I am a lot stupider than I was when I began reading that essay 5 minutes ago. I think we all just got a little dumber looking at the page. What's this all about?" He says, "Well, I don't understand why I've got to pay my mandatory student activities fees to support this offensive speech. Because, you know, they had this pro-gay marriage thing on campus, one of the gay groups on our campus, and they were allowed to set up a booth, and so I decided to set up one that presented a dissenting opinion." He specifically wanted to set up a booth and have an event passing out information about what he thought were the negative effects of same-sex marriage. It was an event that was going to be done in conjunction with the College Republicans. Guess what? The university said, you can't do that because it might offend someone. I said, oh, now I get the point. You're offended by that speech, and we need to take a look at the speech code. Well, I took a look at the Pennsylvania State University speech code, and I will tell you something. It takes a PhD to write something that stupid. It takes dropping acid for a long time and a lot of Grateful Dead concerts to get that bad, because I read it. Oh, my goodness. It said that there was a ban on misdirected laughter. For example, if you told someone a joke and they started laughing but looked in the other direction and someone thought you were laughing at them, that's a violation of the speech code and you can be prosecuted. Belittling jokes, intimidating speech, offensive speech, it went on and on and on and on. And in that particular case, we knew that the remedy was pretty simple. That was a phone call to David French. And that I made that visit in February of 2006. They filed that lawsuit and got a federal injunction and struck down that speech code on that campus in the month of April 2006. And I want to tell you something, guys. I share that story with you for exactly two reasons. That's the new trend. The majority of the application of these campus speech codes now is directed towards religious speech that's protected by the First Amendment and defining any opposition to the homosexual agenda as being hate speech. They say that no one can define hate speech. I can define hate speech. It's speech that leftists hate and lack the intelligence to rebut. So they scream and pitch a fit and exercise the heckler's veto. And that's why we need to respond, because I'll tell you something, you don't know that you're going to go through years of hell and being threatened with rape and being threatened with death. Sometimes you win the victory in 2 months without any bloodshed whatsoever. So that's not the question we need to focus on. How difficult will the fight be? The question we need to focus on is it just? Is it right? And that's the second major thing we need to do. Number one is to fight in the court of public opinion, but number two, to fight in the courts of law. I want to share one more thing with you, can I, before we take a break here in about 5 or 10 minutes. There is an extremely overlooked mechanism in all of this that all of you need to be paying attention to. David French was the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education for only a period of 18 months. But one of the most exciting cases that we ever worked together on, I believe it was in May of 2005, happened at Dartmouth College. Dartmouth College is about the oldest college in the United States of America. It might be. Charter dates back to the 17th century, I believe. And it had been a school where it's predominantly left, but also has a robust right-wing movement. Dinesh D'Souza went there, Laura Ingraham went there. They've got a hyper-politically incorrect magazine, conservative magazine, called the Dartmouth Review. Been a very exciting place for a number of years. When all of a sudden, in 2005, they decide to jump on the speech code bandwagon, and they pass their own campus speech code in May of 2005. And there was a young conservative student there who was absolutely appalled by this. And what does he decide to do? He calls my friend David French at the fire. And he talks to him about what can be done. Man, we need to sue. And he says, we can't sue because this is a private university. And so, you know, you can try and spill blood out there in the court of public opinion to go out there and rough it up and use ridicule and all of that, but you can't file a suit. I'll tell you something. This kid came up with a brilliant idea. He was extremely good friends with an extremely wealthy donor at Dartmouth College. This was the kind of guy who was a 7-digit donor. I don't mean a 7-digit lifetime donor. I'm talking about a guy who would write checks from time to time for over $1 million a pop. This student at Dartmouth, an undergraduate, calls this wealthy alum, and he hears about the speech code. And he says, oh, he says, we're not having a speech code at Dartmouth College. I've heard about those things, and I will under no circumstances ever, ever write a check to Dartmouth College if they pass one of those things. So what does he do? He drafts up a letter, And he said, that speech code decision is going to be extremely costly to you because I am no longer a donor to Dartmouth College. Let me tell you something about rich people, ladies and gentlemen. I'm into stereotypes from time to time. Rich people don't hang out with crackheads. Rich people hang out with other rich people. And this wealthy donor was so upset that he actually ran off Xerox copies of his letters and gave it to all of his wealthy friends. And they all sent them to Dartmouth College. And Dartmouth College figures out, like, 2 weeks after they implement the speech code, this thing's going to cost us about $50 million a year. And Dartmouth College became the first college, in my knowledge, didn't mean the rhyme that time, but the first college in my knowledge to voluntarily, without a court order, rescind its own speech code the same month that they invented it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have powerful tools. We can fight in the court of public opinion. We can fight in the court of law. But let us not forget the donor boycott. Let's not be so silly that we fund an assault on our own cherished values. You guys get on the internet. Find out what your alma mater is doing. Go to the university website and type in the V monologues. Type in LGBT Center and find out what they're doing. If they're sponsoring the V monologues and if they've got a speech code and if they've got an LGBTQIA Center, I don't know what all that stands for, but it's a bunch of crazy stuff, and they've got one of those on my campus. What do? You write a donation. You write a check to your university for exactly 2 cents. And you attach a letter that says, I'm putting in my 2 cents worth. And then right there on that memo line, you know what you do? You write the reason why you're no longer a serious donor to that university. Whether it's the V monologues or the LGBT Center or whatever, but you send in that check for 2 cents, but you make sure you demand a receipt, because then they got to mail you one back, and they just gradually lose money. And if your friends find out about it, you can send a very powerful message very fast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a little something about what we need to do about campus speech codes. But we've got another more serious problem in some ways than the issue of free speech on campuses. We've got a very serious problem dealing with the issue of freedom of association and the treatment of our Christian organizations on our campuses. What I'd like to do is take a 5-minute break and come back and talk about that. Is that okay? 5 minutes, okay?